The best seat in the house, to be able to sit up here by Dominic. Today we'll be going through and hearing a talk from Dominic on city, seduction, and fear. We really want to welcome anybody that may be your first time here. If this is your first time coming to the City Bible Forum, let me just briefly tell you what today will look like. We'll go through and have a brief introduction, and then Dominic will come up and do the talk, or actually we'll have a Bible reading, and then Dominic will come up and do a talk on city, seduction, and fear, based out of Numbers 13. And then, while he's doing the talk, what we encourage you to do, if you see inside your outline, there's a little slip of paper. If you do have any questions for Dominic, based on the talk today, please write them down. And then at the end of the talk, we'll have some of the ladies come and pick those up for you. And then Dominic will go through and answer as many as he can within the time that we have allotted today. So if you would like to, open up your outlines, if you haven't already. Inside, well, I'll just read a brief excerpt out of Numbers chapter 13, starting at sentence number 17. When Moses sent them to explore Canaan, he said, "Go up through the Negev and on into the hill country. See what the land is like and whether the people who will live there are strong or weak, few or many. What kind of land do they live in? Is it good or bad? What kind of towns do they live in? Are they unwalled or fortified? How is the soil? Is it fertile or poor? Are there trees on it or not? Do your best to bring back some of the fruit of the land. It was the season for the first ripe grapes." I'm going to move to number 26. It says here, "They came back to Moses and Aaron and the whole Israelite community at Kadesh in the desert of Paran. There they reported to them and to the whole assembly and showed them the fruit of the land. They gave Moses this account, 'We went into the land with which you sent us. It does flow with milk and honey. Here is its fruit. But the people who live there are powerful, and the cities are fortified and very large. We even saw descendants of Anak there. Amalekites live in the Negev, and the Hittites, and the Jebusites, and the Amorites live in the hill country, and the Canaanites live near the sea and along the Jordan.' Then Caleb silenced the people before Moses, and he said, 'We should go up and take possession of the land, for we can certainly do it.' But the men who had gone up with him said, 'We cannot attack these people. They are stronger than we are. They have spread among the Israelites a bad report about the land that they had explored. They said, "The land we explored devours those living in it. All the people we saw there were of great size. We saw Nephilim there. The descendants of Anak come from Nephilim. We seem like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and we look the same to them." So today, Dominic will talk about the city, seduction, and fear. Dominic?
Hey, look, thanks very much, Russell, and it's nice to see you here at the City Bible Forum this afternoon. And as Russ said, we're looking today at the city and seduction and fear. As a university student, I remember late one Saturday night, working at the computer lab at Sydney University, and then that night walking back to Redfern Station to catch the train to go home. And I still remember that walk because it's one of the few times in my adult life that I've been frightened, like physically frightened, just nervous about kind of gangs, it looked like, walking around Redfern at that time. Another time, though, was my family. We were down camping on the south coast of New South Wales, probably about 5 years ago, and it was over that Christmas New Year period. We were in a caravan park, and it came New Year's Eve, and it just seemed like everybody else in the caravan park was drunk. And in fact, this drunk man was running and then tripped over the guy rope of our tent, string of profanities, broken glass, and my kids were supposed to be inside, well, they were inside the tent and supposed to be asleep, but just fearing for them. But really, for me, as somebody who works in the city, who's male, they're my two incidents as an adult man of being frightened, like physically frightened. I mean, maybe if you're female, that you've got longer list of anxious moments in difficult, but that's my story. But if we move from physical fear to relational fear or anxiety about what people think of me, I mean, it's a much longer list. talking to Peter Kaldor from the City Bible Forum about reputation, and he told me he was sitting next to one of the wheeler dealers of our city, very rich man, owns half a Point Piper, and not Peter, the other bloke. Anyway, this investment banker guy said to Peter, and Peter said to him, "What drives you?" And the man said, it was a reflective moment, and he was being honest. He said, "I think the thing that drives me is fear. Fear that my next deal won't live up to the reputation that I've established." And I think for many of us who work in around this place, that's true for us. Maybe not to the same extent that he's talking about, but it's our reputation, it's our image, it's being seen in a particular light, and fear of not living up to the expectations of other people around in the office, fear of not creating the right impression. And what God is going to do for us today in City Bible Forum is he's actually putting to us that we can be seduced away from trusting in God by fear of what people think. And you might be here today at the City Bible Forum, and you might be here as somebody in long-term relationship with God, began a relationship with God a long time ago, or you might just be putting first steps on the journey into beginning that relationship. But either way, as you came out of the office to here, lunchtime today, you go to lunch fairly regularly, and people say, "Where are you going? What, do the people in your office know where you are right now? And why?" And if they don't know where you are, is it because you're nervous about what they might think of you? You told them, "I'm at the City Bible Forum." We're on a journey in this series, and it's a 9-week journey looking at the whole subject of being seduced. We're taking a break, actually, not next week, the week after. We're taking a break for an Easter special, looking intensely in Easter week at the whole significance of the death of Jesus, and I'm looking forward very very much to speaking on that subject. And look, if you are inviting somebody along from the office for that week, we're going to have free hot cross buns as part of our a City Bible Forum special for you in a fortnight's time. But each of the sessions in this 9-week series, we find ourselves seduced into not trusting God, seduced away from trusting God in a different way. The first way we saw was seduced by food. We then saw seduced by arrogance last week, seduced by fear this week. Next week it's seduced by anger. And then the week after that, seduced away from trusting God on the subject of money, and then seduced by sex. And we're looking through the Old Testament book of Numbers, the fourth book of the Bible, and the plot of will God rescue the Israelite people from slavery here in Egypt? And then the Israelites were slaves, God freed them, 10 plagues, then met them on Mount Sinai, gave them his commandments, told them how to live, to follow him. We've been on a journey through the desert, and today we arrive on the border of the land that God is giving them, right on the edge of the promised land, and they're about to go in. And we're in Numbers chapter 13, sentence 1. If you want to grab that handout sheet, you see on the left-hand page there, "The Lord said to Moses, send some men to explore the land of Canaan, which I'm giving to the Israelites. From each ancestral tribe, send one of its leaders." I actually skipped the print in the printout there. I skipped the list of names, 12 tribes, 12 names. And jumping down to sentence 17, which is actually the next sentence on your sheet, "When Moses sent them to explore Canaan, he said, 'Go up through the Negev and on into the hill country. See what the land is like and whether the people who live there are strong or weak. Few or many, what kind of land do they live in? Is it good or bad? What kind of towns do they live in? Are they unwalled or fortified? How is the soil? Is it fertile or pure poor? Are the trees on it or not? Do your best to bring back some of the fruit of the land.'" Now, little background, it's been a long-standing promise of God to give the people this land. So God made a promise to Abraham. He said to Abraham, "Go to the land I will show you. I'm going to give you descendants. I'm going to give you blessing. I'm going to give you the land." And then God reiterated that promise to Abraham's son Isaac, and then to Abraham's grandson Jacob, and then to Moses. And you see that in earlier book of the Bible, the book of Exodus. And this is God speaking to Moses, Exodus chapter 3, sentence 8. "So I have come down to rescue them from the land of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of that land of Egypt into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites." And now we are right here, right on the brink of it happening. 2 years ago, God did that rescue from Egypt. They camped at Mount Sinai as he gave them the Ten Commandments for 2 years. A fortnight ago, they began that 11-day walk through the desert, and now they're right on the cusp of the promised land. And Moses sends in some spies to whet their appetite for the land that God is about to give them. And so sentence 21, so they went up and explored the land from the desert of Zin as far as Rehob towards Libo Hamath. Then they went through the Negev and they came to Hebron. Now, you'll notice on the screen I put Hebron in yellow, and I think there is actually here a focus on Hebron because it was at Hebron that God made the promise to Abraham. On Sundays at our church, we've been working through the stories of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and working through the back half of this book of Genesis, the book of Genesis, and reading, there's Hebron, and a lot of the action is there, and it really is kind of a key place geographically in the national psyche of Israel. I mean, just like Plymouth Rock is a key place geographically in the national psyche of America, or Botany Bay is a key place geographically in the national psyche of Australia. And so when the Israelite spies go into the promised land, they go, this particular note of visiting where Abraham was buried, where God spoke to Isaac, where God spoke to Jacob. Anyway, verse 23, when they reached the valley of Eshcol, they cut off a branch bearing a single cluster of grapes. Two of them carried it on a pole between them. For two men to be required to carry a bunch of grapes, that is a big bunch of grapes. Anyway, down to 25, at the end of the 40 days, they returned from exploring the land. I take it, looking at the map, it would be a 250-mile north, turn around, 250-mile walk back, and so 40 days is not a bad estimation of the amount of time it would take to do that. The guys get back, and then they give a report. In the report, what happens? They give an objective report, and then they give their analysis. And there's the objective report, and then a majority analysis from 10 of the spies, and then a minority report from 2 of the spies. So let's do the objective bit first. I'm in sentence 26. They came back to Moses and Aaron and the whole Israelite community at Kadesh in the desert of Paran. There they reported to them and to the whole assembly and showed them the fruit of the land. They gave Moses this account. We went into the land to which you sent us, and it does flow with milk and honey. It does flow with milk and honey. Exodus chapter 3, verse 8, God said, I'm going to bring you into a good land flowing with... I'm going to give you a good land flowing with milk and honey. And they come back and say, it flows with milk and honey. And they describe the land and they say, it's just like God promised. And then there is this enormous but. The majority report of the 12 spies, 10 of the 12 spies, say, it flows with milk and honey, but, verse 28, the people who live there are powerful, and the cities are fortified and very large. We even saw descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites live in the Negev, the Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites live in the hill country, and the Canaanites live near the sea and along the Jordan. It's scary. They're scary. I'm scared of those people. And you jump down to 31, they're frightened. The men who'd gone up with him said, we can't attack those people. They're stronger than we are. And they spread among the Israelites a bad report about the land they'd explored. They said, the land we explored devours, eats those living in it. And the people we saw there are great size. We saw the Nephilim there, the descendants of Anak. We seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes. And we looked the same to them. Now, on the screen, that is a very big grasshopper. But in reality, grasshoppers are very small. They're shrimps. We seem like shrimps to them. And they're going to eat us like a shrimp on the barbie. Now, it is crazy flawed analysis. These guys are following the God who made the world. These guys are following the God who defeated the greatest superpower of the age, Egypt. They're following the God who's led them through the desert. Now, I mean, of course, the Amalekites, the Jebusites, the Canaanites, they're enormously powerful. And of course, it's totally impossible for the Israelites to win and take the land in secular strength. But it is possible in God's strength. Now, the difficulty is, and it's a challenge for me, and I take it's a challenge for you, is so often I'm like these majority report people in that, I mean, I believe that God made the universe, and yet do I trust him to work in my life today? I believe that God made the universe, but do I trust that he will be in charge of particular medical tests results? I believe that God made the universe and came into history as a baby. Yet sometimes I believe that it's out of control for God supervising the health of a sick child. Or I allow myself to be intimidated into not trusting God by those other powerful people, by the Amalekites, the Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites, the people who work at KPMG and Price Waterhouse and Westpac and the Macquarie Bank. I'm not physically frightened of those people, but I fear what those people might think of me. Anyway, there's a dissenting minority report. So Caleb and Joshua, two of the spies, they issue a report different to the one compiled by the 10 others. And so 30, Caleb silenced the people before Moses and said, "We should go up there and take possession of the land, for we can do it." Now, essentially, the majority and the minority report agree on the facts. But one says, "We're frightened of the people," and the other says, "We can," or really, "God can." See, jump down to 14:6 on your sheet there. 14:6. Joshua, son of Nun, Caleb, son of Jephunneh, who were among those who explored the land, tore their clothes and said to the entire Israelite assembly, "The land we passed through and explored is exceedingly good. If the Lord is pleased with us, he will lead us into that land, a land flowing with milk and honey, and he will give it to us. Only do not rebel against the Lord. Do not be afraid of the people of the land. We will eat them. We will swallow them up. It's not that they will devour us. We will eat them. Their protection is gone. The Lord is with us. Do not be afraid of them. God rescued us from Egypt. If God can defeat the Egyptians, he can certainly defeat the Canaanites. And the key thing is, say the minority report guys, the key thing is not who's got the greatest amount of military power. The key thing is whose side is God on? And their protection is gone and the Lord is with us. Listen how they describe the land. The majority report people. The majority report people back in 1327, they gave Moses this account. "We went into the land to which you sent us." Listen to how the minority report people describe the land. Verse 8, "A land flowing with milk and honey, and he will give it to us." They're the two reports that are before the people of Israel. And the verdict comes from the National Assembly of People. The Israelites really make a referendum decision. Are they going to go in, as recommended by the minority report, or are they going to stay put, as recommended by the majority report? And really, what happens is they are seduced by fear. So Numbers chapter 14, sentence 1. "That night all the people of the community raised their voices and wept aloud. All the Israelites grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the whole assembly said to them, 'If only we died in Egypt. If only I died in Egypt. If only I died in this desert. Why is the Lord bringing us to this land only to let us fall by the sword? Our wives and children will be taken as plunder. Wouldn't it be better for us to go back to Egypt? To go back to slavery?' And they said to each other, 'We should choose a leader and go back to Egypt.'" Now, from the start of the book of Exodus, all through the book of Exodus, all through the book of Numbers, there's been one plot. And the one plot is God has rescued his people from slavery to the Egyptians in Egypt and brought them all the way to the borders of Canaan. Now, here they are, right on the cusp of achieving the goal of this, and they want to give up. It is a wholesale, complete, total, absolute, unilateral rejection of God. They have totally succumbed to fear. They've rejected God, they've rejected God's rescue mission, and they've rejected God's rescuer, mediator, Moses, because they're frightened of the people who work at KPMG. I mean, for them, it's physical fear. But I do think for us, I mean, we can't point all the fingers at them without having several coming back. It's not so much physical fear. But fear, if I trust God, if I do what I know that He would have me do, that somehow I might drop down in the estimation of people in the office. Somehow I might have my image tarnished, my reputation might go down. That's the dilemma the Christian feels. Will I act in a way that I know God would have me act? Because other people, they just wouldn't understand. But it's also the dilemma that somebody who is just beginning the process of learning to trust Christ feels. Get seduced into thinking, life will be worse if I trust God. And so there's this choice before me. And it's not just before me, but before everybody here. What am I going to choose? Pick a team. Am I going to pick Majority Report, aligning myself with all of Israel, and pick the desert and slavery? Or am I going to pick the Minority Report, align myself with Moses, with Aaron, with Joshua, with Caleb, and God, and the land flowing with milk and honey? Pick a team. I mean, I'm not asking people to call out, hands up, which way and which team am I voting for? That's not what I'm... But in your heart, where are you? And not lip service, but deep down, if you actually analyse the way I've been acting, the way I will act, which team am I on? The Israelites say they're not on the team of God, they're not on the team of Moses, they're not on the team of Aaron, they're not on the team of Joshua, and they're not on the team of Caleb. They want to go back to the desert, go back to Egypt, to slavery. Moses is absolutely horrified at what the people have done. See verse 5, Moses and Aaron fell face down in front of the whole Israelite assembly gathered there. Joshua, son of Nun, Caleb, son of Jephunneh, were among those who had explored the land. They tore their clothes. Moses' horror is the horror of people rejecting God. There's a horror of, rather than choosing the promised land, the land flowing with milk and honey, they've chosen death in the desert and misery and slavery in Egypt. And it's the same today. It's right to be horrified. It is right to be horrified at the choices that people make. Right across our city, isn't it the case that the majority are choosing to reject God? And right across our city, the majority are choosing not the land flowing with milk and honey. They're not choosing heaven. They're choosing slavery in Egypt. They're choosing to die in the desert. They're choosing... Is he going to say it? That awful four-letter word. Hell. And why? Because they fear what other people in the office might think. What Moses and Aaron and Joshua and Caleb and Dominic have said is so unpalatable that sentence 10, verse 10, the whole assembly talked about stoning them. And then the glory of the Lord appeared at the tent of meeting to all the Israelites. The whole of Israel's gathered about to stone Moses and Aaron to death, and God turns up. How are you feeling towards me at this moment? You think, oh, Dominic, he's gone a bit fire, hellfire brimstone this morning, this afternoon. I don't want to be a hellfire brimstone person. But I want to stand with Moses. God gives his reaction. Listen to the voice of God. What does God say? Verse 11. The Lord said to Moses, how long will these people treat me with contempt? How long will they refuse to trust me, to believe in me, in spite of all the miraculous signs that I've performed among them? I rescued them from Egypt. I will strike them down with a plague and destroy them, but I'll make you into a great nation, greater than them. Now, there is absolutely no argument that the people of Israel don't deserve the just judgment of God at this point. This is justice. People have rebelled against God. He judges. Moses, his role is mediator. To stand between God and the people, Moses mediates. And he pleads on behalf of the people. Hey, now, What kind of argument could he put? He can't put the argument, actually, God, they're really good guys, because they're not. He can't run that argument. Jesus can't say to the Father, Dominic, he's a really good guy, because he's not. Moses puts the only available argument, and he bases it on the character of God. He says, oh, God, please don't do it because of your glory and your mercy. So glory first, sentence 15. If you put these people to death all at one time, the nations who've heard this report about you will say, the Lord was not able to bring the people into the land he promised them on oath, so he slaughtered them in the desert. Don't do it for the sake of your reputation. Second argument, 17. Now may the Lord's strength be displayed just as you've declared. The Lord is slow to anger, abounding in love and forgiving sin and rebellion. Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children for the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation. God, please don't do it, says Moses. In accordance with your great love, forgive the sin of these people, just as you've pardoned them from the time they left Egypt till now. You've pardoned them again and again and again and again. Please continue to be merciful. Don't treat them with justice, treat them with mercy. Verse 20, the Lord replied, I have forgiven them as you asked. God does not destroy them with the plague that he originally intended to. That would have been just. But his zeal, his passion for justice, won't let them say, oh, well, boys will be boys. Doesn't matter. No, this is what God says, 28, so tell them, as surely as I live, declares the Lord, I will do to you the very things I heard you say. You wanted to go out into the desert? Will go out into the desert, verse 29. In this desert, your bodies will fall, every one of you, 20 years old or more, who was counted in the census. Remember we had a census right at the beginning of the book? Every one of you, 20 years old, who was counted in the census, who's grumbled against me, will die. You wanted to go back to Egypt, will start walking. You're going to be walking in the desert 40 years, 30. Not one of you will enter the land I swore with uplifted hand to make your home, except Caleb, minority report guy who trusted me, and Joshua. Why those two? They trusted God. As for you, your children, that you said would be taken by plunder, I mean, that was what the Israelites' fear was. My kids will be taken by plunder if we go into Canaan. I will bring them in to enjoy the land you've rejected. But you, your bodies will fall in the desert. Your children will be shepherds here for 40 years, suffering for your unfaithfulness until the last of your bodies lies in the desert. For 40 years, 1 year for each of the 40 days you explored the land, you'll suffer for your sins and know what it is like to have me against you. I, the Lord, have spoken. And I will do these things to this whole wicked community which has banded together against me. They will meet their end in the desert. Here they will die. God is just. And against the backdrop of his justice, he's merciful. God is passionate for justice. But with injustice, God acts mercifully. They wanted to die in the wilderness. Well, God says, I'll give you what you want. But I'll have mercy on your children and I'll bring them in. They had a choice between fearing the people of the land and trusting God. And they chose to fear the people of the land and to reject God. It's the same today. Jesus puts it like this in Luke chapter 12, verse 4. I tell you, my friends, do not be afraid of those who kill the body and after that can do no more. Don't fear the people who work at Price Waterhouse. Don't fear the people who work with you at Macquarie Bank. Don't fear the people who work with you at Westpac. Do not be afraid of those who can kill the body and after that do no more. I'll show you whom you should fear, who you should respect. Fear him who after the killing of the body has the power to throw you into hell. Fear him who is the judge of heaven and earth. I tell you, fear him. Are not five sparrows sold for 2 pennies, yet not one of them is forgotten by God? Indeed, the very hairs of your head are numbered. Don't be afraid. You're worth more than many sparrows. There it is on the lips of Jesus, the challenge to us to fear God, not against the opinions of our colleagues. And we see here the promise of Jesus, that God loves us, that God is for us. I've only done this once, but lying in bed with my wife on a Saturday morning, before children, I decided to embark on a project of counting the hairs of her head. After about 2 square centimetres and 25 minutes, I gave up. And you can see how much more committed God is to me than I am to Kathy. He knows every hair on my head. He is that for me. And yet he gives me what I want. If I spend my whole life saying, I want to reject you, God. I don't want any part of you. Leave me alone. I'd rather be back in slavery. I'd rather be dying in the desert. I'd rather not have a relationship with you. Then when I die, I get that. Eternity without him. Hell, he treats me with dignity. A reaction of the people back then, they mourned. 39, instead of going where he told them, which was out in the desert, they try to take Canaan in their own strength without God. 39, when Moses reported this to the Israelites, they mourned bitterly. Early the next morning, they went up towards the high hill country. We have sinned, they said. We will go to the place where the Lord promised. But Moses said, why are you disobeying the Lord's command? This will not succeed. Do not go up. The Lord is not with you. You'll be defeated by your enemies, for the Amalekites and Canaanites will face you there. Because you've turned away from the Lord, he will not be with you, and you'll fall by the sword. And that is, in fact, what happens. My wife and kids, we read the Bible together as a family. We aim to do it every night of the week. We probably get there 3 or 4 nights a week. And often when I read the Bible, we read the Bible as a family. I try to read the same thing with them that I'm teaching in another forum. It just kind of helps me get my head in gear, helps me to work through the ideas. And this week, we've been reading Numbers. And we're up to chapter 13 and 14, and on Tuesday night we read chapters 13 and 14. And we got into a discussion as a family about who do you fear? And my kids thought the Israelites were crazy. Absolutely crazy. I mean, right there on the edge of the promised land, and they turned away. And then one of my boys talked about, it is a bit rough sometimes at school when you're the only kid in the class who's Christian. He goes to Annandale Public School, most secular district in New South Wales. And the only kid in his class, teased for being Christian, teased for standing up to Jesus, and there is a pressure on him to walk away from Jesus. But it's not just him, it's us as adults, and it's me. I mean, I care, I've realised, deeply about what other people think of me. It plays out for me at all sorts of levels. At one level, I like to think I'm an independent maverick who speaks without fear or favour, but at our church, we're doing a building renovation at the moment, and the Anglican Church is deciding whether or not it'll give us some money to help us. And a grant to help us in our building project. And will they, won't they, will they, won't they? And I had a conversation this week with the architect who's, and I got off the phone, he said, how do you reckon we're going in our grant application? And I realised after my conversation, I do want the grant because I want the money. But I also want the grant because I think if they don't give us the grant, it'll be like they don't value me. They don't. And I realised how deeply concerned I am about my own reputation and image in their eyes and what people think of me. But all of us do, don't they? Isn't that the case? I mean, you come to City Bible Forum and are you going to get fired for going to lunch? No. There's 4% unemployment and a churn rate in most companies of 40%. You're not going to get fired for going to lunch. They're going to flick you for coming to City Bible Forum. But they're all sitting there with their sandwiches at their desk, and they might look down their nose at you. And we are tempted to fear that. Russell.
Well, if you want to, if you haven't already, you want to write down some of your questions and write those on the slips of paper, and Janet and Amelie would be able to walk around and pick those up, and then we'll have Dominic answer those in just a few minutes. One of the things we want to encourage you is obviously coming along to the Easter special that we'll be having in a few weeks. Next week, we'll have a flyer in the outline for you. And looking around the room, I see different representatives from different companies. I see people from Telstra, HSBC, Ernst & Young, and Qantas even. And what they do, they're actually representing some of their in-house groups. And that's one of the ministries that I have the opportunity of overseeing at Ecom, and is people who do ministry within their organizations. And this Easter talk that's going to be coming up in a couple weeks, it would be a great way for you to be able to invite people to come along to hear a talk about Jesus and what he's done for us and who he is. And so I just really encourage your groups not only to do that for the Easter talk, but also even utilizing this as their a Bible talk each week and coming along for that. So thank you for those that do bring along different groups. There are different groups that actually commit to bringing along a table, and we're very thankful for that. But also just encourage you to invite people from work to come along and hear these talks from Dominic and our other various speakers. So thanks, Dominic. I'll turn it back over to you.
Okay, first one, how do you cure fear? Well, if fear of people is the opposite to trusting God, I take it the thing that I want to do is work at increasing my trust of God. One of the lines that comes to my mind is Philippians chapter 4, verse 6, do not be anxious about anything, but in everything, commit it to God in prayer. And what is prayer? It's an expression that I trust God. So I want to run to prayer, run to God in trust. Never fear, Dominic, we love you too. Oh, thank you. Why, if God forgives the Israelites, does he still punish them? Yeah, there is still a punishment. There is still a consequence of their action. I take it that there's three purposes in punishment. There's a retributive purpose in punishment. There's a deterrence purpose in punishment. And there's a cure purpose in punishment. He doesn't give them the full retributive punishment that they deserve, but still there is a deterrence punishment. Still there's a consequence for their actions that they've got to work out. My little boy knocked a pear into our next door neighbour's backyard a fortnight ago, and we're really a problem for our next door neighbours because there's so many ball sports going on in our backyard. There's all sorts of balls going into the yard all the time, and they've got pot plants, and really it was the end of the extreme to get a pear in the backyard, having got all the different balls over the, and I mean, the punishment for me was that he had to write a letter to apologise to them and to go and take it to them. I mean, he wasn't spanked for it, but there was still a consequence of his actions that he had to work through. And I think that's what's happening here. Who are the Nephilim? Big scary creatures. Genesis 6 and Genesis 9 are the place to go. And I don't know much more than what Genesis 6 and Genesis... I don't know any more than what Genesis 6 and Genesis 9 says. Numbers 14, verse 9, was God advocating cannibalism? No, I think that was just me getting rhetorical. It's we will devour them, they will devour us. It's just war, as you've said in the rest of your comment. Thank you, Russell.
Always good questions at City Bible Forum. We want to encourage you to come back next week. Next week it'll be City, Seduction, and Anger. Thanks again for today, and have a great week. Thanks.